Wendy Ray.
And I'm Brian Curtis. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories about climate action from the bottom up.
This is part one of what I think will be a two-part series exploring what people are doing to address the climate impacts of fast fashion. And in honor of the occasion, I am wearing a pair of pants that I bought from an online thrift store.
Hey, me too.
Yeah, we're so eco-groovy.
Today's video is going to be a giant, giant Shein haul. Let's start off with this. Ooh, these are some pants. They're cute. I love these so much. These are like my new favorite pants. 10 out of 10 for sure. Let's see what's next. Wait, these shorts fit me perfectly. These are so freaking cute. Completely 10 out of 10. This is another bag, and I'm very excited for this one. It's like Christmas. OMG.
That's what's called a haul. People making videos of themselves opening a big box of clothes that they bought online. This one went on for 20 minutes.
That's a lot of clothes. In this case, they came from Shein, a Chinese company which is the world's largest producer of fast fashion.
I could tell you all about fast fashion, but what fun would that be when Raleigh Williams can do it so much better?
This is a guy I've been wanting to introduce everyone to. He's a comedian with a degree in climate policy from Columbia University, and he goes out on the streets of New York and makes these YouTube videos about climate change. And people listen to him because he's funny. Here's Raleigh's take on fast fashion.
Whenever I need to look like the kind of guy who understands fashion, I cram myself into a suit that looks like it was made for some kind of European heroin addict. And for the low price of $30, you too can walk out of an H&M dressed like your Slender Man's younger brother. In fact, at prices like these, it can be more expensive to clean your clothes than it is to throw away your dirty clothes and buy all new ones. And I know that sounds like the kind of plan that was invented by some sort of 9-year-old king, but it's actually pretty close to reality, because the average garment in America is worn just 7 times before it's thrown away. And if you're thinking, well, whew, it's a good thing I donate my clothes to other people, that's not actually happening. Oh, you're donating your clothes, but that basically just means that your clothes take a little trip to the Salvation Army, where they say thank you for your service, before 90% of all clothes donated to a thrift store get rejected and sent straight to a landfill or a textile waste mill. With stores like H&M, Uniqlo, Zara, Guess, and Gap selling low-quality clothes at bargain basement prices, Americans buy an average of 68 items of clothing every year, which seems like a lot of clothes. But it's not even all the clothes, because 10% of clothing produced gets worn 0 times because it never gets bought and it just goes straight into the garbage. Fast fashion is so big and wasteful that it produces more CO2 than France, Germany, and the UK combined. Fast fashion is devastating to the climate, and it is a husky-sized human rights violation, but it is so profitable that it's projected to triple by 2050 unless we change something. We are currently knocking on the door of a climate catastrophe, and how we deal with fast fashion may determine if we're able to avoid some of the worst parts of a climate disaster. But unlike most of the systemic causes of climate change, there's actually something you can do about fast fashion, maybe? Now, fashion wasn't always about buying $5 dresses or trying to look like a sexy haystack. Mission very much accomplished, by the way.
To save time here, we'll skip Raleigh's synopsis of 2 centuries of garment labor history.
Everything I've described so far is traditional, slow fashion. Clothing is designed, manufactured, shipped, and sold domestically. And as recently as... I'm not gonna die for this video. As recently as 1990, more than half the clothes bought in America were also made in America. But between 1990 and now, so much manufacturing went overseas that America now makes less than 2% of its clothes. And now almost every item of clothing worn in America has to first make a CO2-intensive international trip. And we're not talking about one little international trip to Paris and back. Since the only thing manufacturers really care about is minimizing production costs, the life of a shirt might begin with cotton grown in India, then get sent to Mexico to be processed, then get sent to Bangladesh to be sewn together, then get sent to Colombia to have the tag sewn on, then get sent to Miami to be distributed to a store in Georgia. But what's a little 1,000 tons of heat-trapping gas in the atmosphere if it means you could buy this very real shirt that says, "Fridays, we be like squad goals." And just to be clear, clothing manufacturers didn't move their factories to other countries so that they could make better clothes. They did it so they could go back to treating their workers like they did in 1911. Now, since companies didn't have to pay for vacations or health insurance or fire extinguishers, their profits shot through the roof like a drunken cowboy. And sure, these major American manufacturing companies who move their factories to China, India, Bangladesh, etc., could have used that money to pay their workers a living wage. And they did! Not. Shit, they did not. They used that money to expand executive salaries by 500%. But wait, it gets worse, because as the cost of manufacturing clothes shot through the floor like a drunken cowboy's upstairs neighbor, clothing companies were able to sell clothes for cheaper, which means people were able to buy more clothes. And not like an extra shirt that says, "Catch up with Jesus," or "My other shirt is a truck." The average American is now buying 5 to 6 articles of clothing every month, which is 5 times more than we did in the 1980s, the decade we did everything right.
This is something that has spiraled out of control largely in my lifetime.
That's Emily Stokel. She's the Director of Education and Community Engagement at REMAKE, a global advocacy organization fighting for fair pay and climate justice in the clothing industry.
If we think back to how previous generations wore their clothes, you know, there were typically 4 fashion cycles a year, and people purchased clothes and wore them till they absolutely fell to pieces, which didn't happen for a very long time because the clothing was made to last. But then fashion brands realized that they could actually make more money by getting people to shop more often, and they started to speed up that cycle. And so some of the big fast fashion brands, like the H&Ms, Zaras of the world, they started speeding up that cycle to where new clothing was coming out not just 4 times a year, 4 seasons a year, but 52 times a year, weekly drops instead of seasonal drops. And what's absolutely mind-blowing is that that was considered the epitome of fast fashion, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago. Now, it's even faster than that. Some of the biggest fast fashion brands in the world produce new clothing every single day. Tons and tons of new items, new styles, new designs. Another fashion system is possible. It has existed before and it can exist again. One that is slower and higher quality. That world is out there.
Well, we can click our ruby slippers, but bringing textile production back on American soil will not be easy because we no longer have those facilities for turning raw material into cloth.
Fibershed is a national network of natural fiber producers, dyers, spinners, weavers, and others working to fill in the gaps.
Rachel Higgins is a professor of fashion design and merchandising at Drexel University and the leader of Fibershed's Pennsylvania affiliate, the Textile and Clothing Coalition.
Pennsylvania was actually one of the biggest capitals for flax production, and flax is linen. I mean, we can grow it. It grows here amazingly well, but we don't actually have any of the machinery. There's people doing it by hand. I always joke that it would be like $1,000 to produce a napkin that was just made completely locally right now. So yeah, there's just a lot of parts of the puzzle that we're missing.
There's another group working on bringing back flax. Rachel's group is working on woolen alpaca because Pennsylvania does have some woolen mills, although not enough to meet demand. And there's a lot of other processing that needs to happen between the farm and the mill.
I learned that we have a lot of farmers in Pennsylvania who are farming fiber, but really didn't realize how disconnected the supply chain is from a lamb on a farm going all the way to the finished product. They're really trying to bridge the gap between all of these different parts of the supply chain.
The coalition is helping people make those connections.
We had some calls with producers and people along different steps of the supply chain. And one of the coolest things was a yarn shop was on the call and she was saying, "I'm really looking for 100% locally made wool yarn. My customers are asking for it. I can't find it anywhere." And we happen to have a farmer on the call as well who said, "I have a whole barn full of wool yarn. I can't sell it and I can't figure out what to do with it." And so they were able to make that connection. So I think it's small things like that that can really end up making a big difference. There's several brands that have maybe one sweater that's produced completely locally, but I haven't seen this done across the board because it's cost prohibitive.
Up against the juggernaut of fast fashion, these are baby steps. It's still essential work because if we truly want circular fashion and want to keep the oil in the ground, we have to get back to natural fiber.
60%, 60, of present-day clothing is made of petrochemicals. Nylon, spandex, polyester, yep, all made of oil.
Since we've already got a gazillion tons of discarded synthetics, can't we just keep recycling them?
Recycling clothing is not the same as, like, you recycle a water bottle and you can make a new water bottle, or you take an aluminum can and you melt it down and make it into a new aluminum can. It's much more complex because most of our clothing is made of mixed fiber.
For example, the stuff that makes your jeans stretch prevents that denim from being recycled into new garments. It can only be downcycled into stuff like insulation, even when material is 100% pure.
All the fibers have to be broken down. It's very water intensive and energy intensive, and so that's not really the solution.
The simplest solution for the climate is don't buy new.
Buy secondhand and rent. Anytime I go to a wedding now, I'm not buying a dress. I rent something that I'm going to wear one time, and then I send it back.
Rental is no longer just for formal wear either. There are monthly subscription services that work like clothes libraries.
There definitely is hope. My students now versus my students I had even 2 years ago, a lot of them shop secondhand or vintage. That's actually a big piece of what my students now shop. A few years ago, they would never do that. This is such a cultural shift. We're marketed to all the time to buy, be on trend, get what's new, especially with Instagram and TikTok and all these other social media platforms. They want to have a cute outfit to post a picture of themselves, and then they don't want to be seen in it again.
Emily's other hat, aside from Remake, is a pair of headphones. She's working to promote that culture change with her pre-loved podcast.
I talk about thrifting, vintage selling, textile recycling, swapping, mending, all that good stuff, all the joy that exists within the secondhand fashion industry. I love the story behind clothing. I love when pieces have a special memory attached to them, when there's a connection to the maker of the clothing. That's just why vintage and secondhand is so special to me, because it so often has those really nice stories attached to it.
So tell us one.
I found a really cool pair of railroad striped Oshkosh Bagosh overalls at the thrift store, and they fit me perfectly, but unfortunately they had a lot of big holes in them. Again, they had been clearly like worn and loved, but I was like, I know these are really high quality. I know that if these holes weren't there, that this piece would last for years and years. And so I actually asked a good friend who is a quilter to make me some patches. And it's a piece that sometimes folks will ask me about, and then I get to tell them this great story about that incredible thrift find and about my friend and her pieces that she makes. And so that's a favorite.
Circulating clothes can build community.
The t-shirt that has like a local high school on it, it brings back memories for people. They're like, oh, I remember that, or I remember going to that event or that county fair. And I just love that by keeping clothes for longer and sharing them around our community, we can stay connected to those stories.
Right now, secondhand clothes make up a small percentage of what's in the average American's closet. But this is changing. In 2021, 53% of U.S. adults reported buying secondhand clothing in the previous month. 65% of Gen Zers report that they thrift always or very often.
And as a sign of the changing times, secondhand has cachet. More than half of those who bought secondhand for the first time in 2021 say it gives them bragging rights. And they go out of their way to tell people they are wearing secondhand.
The secondhand clothes market is growing so fast that some analysts predict it will be twice the size of the fast fashion market by 2030, potentially displacing as much as 30% of fast fashion sales, enough to put those companies out of business.
Of course, sustaining that market growth requires a lot of secondhand clothes, 85% of which are now going to landfills.
On November 1st, 2022, Massachusetts became the first state to ban textiles from their landfills.
It's trash day, I'm putting you out, it's trash day, putting you out, it's trash day, putting you out of my mind. It's trash day, I'm putting you out.
Residents and businesses there throw away roughly 230,000 tons of textiles a year, and they were running out of places to put it.
According to the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, 85% of that could be reused or recycled.
Now it's up to Massachusetts cities and towns to figure out how to make that happen.
A number of them are partnering with HelpSee, a company that helps discarded garments find new homes. Helpsy has contracts with 26 cities, including Boston, Arlington,
Salem, Malden, Tinsboro, Watertown, Cambridge, Billerica, Ipswich, Westboro, Attleboro, Georgetown, Brookline, Medford.
Lisa Chanella is the company's chief of staff.
We have a couple of models that we can offer municipalities. We do curbside pickup directly from people's residents. We also do clothing drives. And then we also have quite a large number of collection bins on municipal properties, parking lots and parks, and even the public school system. All of the logistics and the trucking is taken care of by Helpsy. So the lift for the municipality, we hope, is as light as possible.
The stuff being thrown away has so much value that Helpsy is able not only to offer their collection services for free, but also pay cities and organizations hosting their bins and still make a profit.
So how does this work? Say I live in Boston and I got a bag of clothes I don't want.
Well, you just go to their website and make an appointment for pickup. They'll take clean clothes in any condition.
And the only thing we ask is that you put it in a bag. Any bag will do, and people leave it on their front porch, depending on if it's an apartment. They'll leave notes in the appointment section like, hey, I'm in this apartment, you got to buzz so-and-so, or I left it behind the mailbox, or wherever it is so that we can find the clothing. One of the things I love doing right from the beginning was I was like, take me on a route. You have an app on your phone that tells you which addresses to go to. It's connected to Google Maps. You follow, and then you're like, all right, I'm at this place. You look for the bags. It's like a treasure hunt, too. When you're on the route after so many hours, all you're looking for is like, are those clothes bags? Are those clothes bags? When you start getting close to the destination, you find the bags, take a photo of it on that same app. You put up in the truck, you swipe and go to the next.
It's like Uber for clothes.
When your route is done, you go back to the warehouse, and then things are either sorted or bailed.
Once the clothes get to the warehouse, the treasure hunt continues.
I found these brand new red Nike Jordans in a box. You could tell nobody had walked on them. I think I had the perception that perhaps many of us do, that what we find in the bins is like junk, that there's nothing there. Like, who would get rid of perfectly new red Jordans? Like, who would do that? But people are doing that. And so how do we connect the items with their best end use? How do we extend their useful life? So doing the routes and like going through the bags, it's kind of like a treasure hunt because you do find some really weird things, but then you find, you know, gems, and there's vintage, and there was a stack of Burberry coats that somebody else had found. I'm like, could you imagine? Like, that was just waiting to be trashed.
Helpsy sorts through some of its loads to pick out clothes for resale. Popular brands in good condition get photographed and sold in Helpsy's online secondhand store for prices ranging from $15 to $50.
Some of the rescued clothes are packed into what Lisa calls mystery boxes, with categories like women's outerwear, new with tags, or by popular brands. These are sold to thrift stores and individuals who resell online on sites like eBay, Poshmark, and Mercari.
And then there's the stuff that's not fit for reuse.
Some of the lower quality stuff is sold as rags. So if it's one sock, that like reasonably nobody's going to want one sock, right? No one's going to buy that. But it does have use as insulation or a rag. That's better than putting it in the trash.
And not all the truckloads are sifted through for recoverable items. Some are simply baled. And here's where it gets a little murky. Lisa says most of the bales go to Texas, and she thinks from there to thrift stores in Mexico, which, if they're like thrift stores in the U.S., means a lot will end up in a landfill just in Mexico instead of Massachusetts. I couldn't get anyone at Helpsy to tell me, and I tried, what percentage of clothing they bale versus sort. But last year they reported salvaging enough clothes to prevent the greenhouse gas equivalent of 55,000 cars. The Massachusetts textile ban is a work in progress. There are no police out looking at people's garbage cans, and it will take time for people to learn not to put their clothes in the trash.
Some municipalities that are pay-as-you-throw communities, which means they have to pay for every garbage bag that they throw out, those communities typically are more attuned to like, okay, well, how can I reduce my trash, right? Because the more trash I have, the more I have to pay. So if I can send two bags of clothing to Helpsy for free.
Helpsy may not be in your area now, but that could change.
Right now, we're in about 14 states. We opened 5 new states this year, and we're kind of looking one day to be national. The more that people are reusing clothing, then ultimately, long term, the production has to go down, right? And that's ultimately, I think, how we fix the problem.
we could end the story here, it would be a real feel-good piece. But now I'm going to bring on the guy who is about to pop our balloon. His name is Roland Geyer, and he's a professor of industrial ecology and pollution prevention at the Brenn School of Environmental Science and Management at UC Santa Barbara. He's also the author of a book called The Business of Less.
The subtitle is The Role of Companies and Households on a Planet in Peril, which I think is not overly dramatic these days.
Basically, Professor Geyer's conclusion is that corporate sustainability efforts are doomed unless companies are willing to shrink, which they're not.
I would definitely say that there is more talk than walk, fair amount of just trying to make the environmental pressure and heat go away rather than really solve the environmental problem. Also, some may be wishful thinking that finding, say, a magical green fabric could make apparel sustainable. But I've just come to the conclusion that that's not really going to work. Lots of companies now are making sort of net zero greenhouse gas emissions promises, but at the same time, they also want to grow their sales and revenues year over year. I can't see how they're going to achieve that.
Because it doesn't help to cut the emissions to make one, say, shirt, if you keep increasing the number of shirts you make. Roland is a numbers kind of guy, so I asked him if the rising popularity of shopping secondhand was actually slowing the production of new garments.
Sadly not. The annual data, new fabric production, new cloth sales, they're all just trending up. So whatever reuse and recycling activity there is in the apparel space, it certainly has not led to a flattening or even a decrease in new garment consumption. It could just be that we just buy a few vintage clothes on top of all the new clothes.
Or maybe it's just that the trend is so small that it can't be seen against the massive output of fast fashion. Yet.
Maybe in 2 years, you know, we should talk again.
So it's not enough to buy vintage clothing. We really need a return to vintage attitudes.
The cost of clothing has gone down over the last several generations. We've become accustomed to cheap clothing. It can be shocking to people when they start to see how much clothing should really cost when it's made ethically and sustainably. But part of that is tied up in that mindset of we should be able to have new things every single week. And I think we have to start to detangle, should we? Do we need to have new things every single week? Or is there another way of doing things where we buy high quality things that we love and that are meant to last us for a long time, like previous generations, and we spend more on those pieces, but we perhaps save more in the long run because we're not buying stuff all the time. But it's also true that wages haven't risen proportionately. And so I'm not trying to shame people for not wanting to spend more on clothing. I absolutely understand why that doesn't feel possible for people. But I think it's not about going out and buying new garments all the time that are sustainably made. What I'd like people to think about is, can you exist with less? Can you buy less? Can you give up buying new clothes for a period of time? Because I think that's how we really reduce the overconsumption issue.
To kick the habit of continuous clothes shopping, Emily suggests this DIY detox.
Take a 90 days of no new clothes pledge, where basically you don't buy any new clothing for 90 days. And that is a way to help you break that habit. And the 90 days is based off of research from fitness trainers or dietitians, that if you want to build a habit that lasts, a good way to approach it is to build a foundation of 90 days. And then after those 90 days, your habit is much more likely to stick. It can be very empowering and leave you a lot happier to realize that you don't have to stay on that hamster wheel that these businesses have entrapped us in. It's a perfect first step because it's so accessible to everyone. All we're asking you to do is not spend any money on new clothing and see how you feel.
Emily's role at Remake is engaging young people and turning them into activists.
I'm able to zoom into classrooms all over the country. What I'm finding is that young people have already heard about fast fashion. They know about the overconsumption problems, and they're really interested in how do I make a difference? We have change makers all across the world, and we do collective action organizing.
One thing they work on is increasing wages for garment workers.
Higher wages could really revolutionize that whole business model of fast fashion because it would force those companies to have to slow down and make less in the first place.
That would increase the price of clothes. It would make us consume less. And labor is the one production input that actually has zero environmental impact.
Increasing wages for garment workers could even have a kind of Robin Hood effect that would cut greenhouse gas emissions even more.
If we spend money on stuff, it just goes to the people that own the company that makes stuff. So it always goes to people. The question is just which people does it go to and what do they do with that money? My hope is that redirecting money from, say, shareholders of companies that sell stuff to better the livelihood of garment workers would actually be environmentally beneficial.
Because the wealthiest people have the biggest carbon footprints. Workers would be far more likely to spend their wages on groceries than vacation homes and intercontinental air travel. But getting that money for workers won't happen without a fight.
In the next episode, you'll hear the story of a small group of garment workers who, with the help of support of remake activists and other allies, won passage of a state law protecting garment workers from wage theft.
And became the template for a federal bill which could do the same thing nationwide. I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. You've been listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. Want more Cool Solutions? You'll find 4 years of solutions stories free wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks to Raleigh Williams,
Emily Stokel, Rachel Higgins,
Lisa Chanella, and Roland Geyer. And thanks to Scott Holmes, Lobo Loco, Dilating Times, Smokey Hormel, One Man Book, and Reverend Billy's Stop Shopping Choir for our music.